When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Assassin's Creed Origins isn't a full reboot of the long-running series, but because it's set before the Assassins and Templars, it's about as close as you can get without wiping the slate clean. Thing is, that's exactly what Ubisoft should have done. It's all dead weight. Those are the words, of course, of Patrick Klepek in a piece he wrote today about Assassin's Creed would be a better series without the sci-fi garbage. I am your host, Danielle Riendo. This is Waypoint Radio, and today we're going to be talking about sci-fi garbage and Assassin's Creed as well. You've already heard some woo-woo in the background there from Patrick. How you doing today,
Patrick? I don't even know why we have to have a discussion. I feel like my article is an open and shut case. It is inarguable. I feel this is perfunctory. I'll have the discussion, but I feel like this is impugning my character that we even have to pretend that I haven't presented the most reasonable argument for getting rid of the garbage.
Well, I mean, considering how long we spent on Alien Alloys, I feel like we've got to really also mine this. You know, we've got to also take a look at this.
I'm not going to pretend that Waypoint, we say, oh, we're in it, social justice. No, we're about garbage. We're just about, like, wallowing in fucking garbage. So when the video games are slow, here's what I'm for, wallowing in garbage. So we're here. It's 2018. It's also going to be garbage like 2017 and 2016.
Pretty much. Also agreed. And here, perhaps, to argue a different case, because, you know, we're here to wallow in garbage and we're here to do it right. So we also have a counterpoint from a special guest and frequent Waypoint contributor, Cameron Kunzelman. Cameron, how are you today? Are you feeling the sci-fi garbage today?
Feeling like a garbage man today. I feel like I'm coming to clean up these streets.
Oh,
get rid of this trash, epic.
Fighting words right there, fighting words.
So I'm sure Garbage Man is one of the important side characters from the Assassin's Creed the movie tie-in novel that you also have to understand in order to finally fit all the pieces together. Okay, Cameron,
played by Jeremy Irons.
Cameron, you tweeted something just I don't want to talk about the thesis of my piece right now, because you need to clear something up for me. You mentioned in a tweet talking about how to better understand where AC Origins fits into the larger meta narrative of Assassin's Creed by saying that you actually had to read something Assassin's Creed as a series acknowledges that the Assassin's Creed movie, which I watched a couple of months ago, and it is unbelievable garbage. Like, I'm sorry.
It's so bad.
I apologize to the word garbage that I use to describe the sci-fi trappings of the series, because the movie is actual garbage. So are you arguing that there is, like, fiction in Origins that is saying that what happens in that movie is also canonical? Is that true?
Yes, a million percent.
Explain, please.
What is the name of the contemporary character in there?
In the movie? Don't ask me to remember details.
In Origins, the woman who's like delving through Hayek's memories.
Is it like Lauren or something? I don't know. The fact that neither of us can remember maybe says everything.
Hassan is her last name, I believe.
The new Desmond, it seems like.
Yes.
Desmond 2.0.
Desmond 2.0, in between when you kind of bump forward to the future, you know, you can do the same things you used to be able to do as Desmond, which is walk and look at like four different things and then check your email. Right. Good. And so that's where like a huge amount of the Abstergo stuff comes through in that game. And there are several different like files that you can look at on her laptop. And one of them
Layla.
Is
Layla. I'm sorry. Layla. I found it. You weren't too far off.
At least I got an L. So, like that's
Google, yeah.
It's as far as what cemented into my brain was, like, an L name.
There you go. But, sorry, go ahead, Cameron.
No. I'm glad we got it. But yeah, so if you read through these emails, there's, you know, because she is a animus researcher kind of thing. That's kind of the plot that's going on with her. And there is an explicit discussion from the Assassin's Creed movie. I don't want to spoil this movie for people who might be very invested in watching it.
Spoiler, it's bad.
it's not very good. There's like a couple pieces. One talks about the assassination at the end of that movie.
Right.
The kind of like big set piece assassination. And then there are several emails about the quote-unquote better design of the giant 3D armature animus from the movie. Clay is the from Revelations, the guy in the animus. But anyway, whatever, the Michael Fassbender character,
right.
He's mentioned as well.
I mean, I guess that makes sense because if Origins is a game that's made over like, you know, a 3 to 5 year period, that at one point in the development they said that movie's going to be a success, and then it wasn't. Because Ubisoft definitely positioned that movie as, oh, this is going to be a big tentpole part of like our meta-narrative going forward. So I guess it makes sense that they would leave some reference. That's funny, though. Don't watch that movie.
Well, I mean, the movie took the place of a game last year, right?
Pretty much. I have a friend and neighbor who is, he plays a decent amount of video games, but like the series he loves is Assassin's Creed. And so one night, like usually like every Friday or Saturday, we all get together and we watch a movie. And he was like, yo, let's, that, like, Assassin's Creed was on like a 99-cent rental on iTunes. And I was like, okay, finally, like, let's just watch this. How bad can it be? And like, he fell asleep through the movie. My wife fell asleep through the movie. I had to watch it all the way through. I had to see it through to the end.
By yourself at that point.
Well, I paid a dollar. Like, I've watched things for worse, you know? Sure. Actually, maybe I should flip this around. It's actually remarkable how bad it is. It's made with, like, a competent director who had, like, done, like, an adaptation of, like, some Shakespearean something like with Fassbender, and who's the actress who's in it, who's like also like
Marion Cotillard,
yeah, like
oh,
these,
yeah,
are
she's pretty good,
fucking legit, yeah. Like they tried to say like, look, we know these movies are bad or these games are bad, the stories suck, but like we'll just kind of eke out a good movie out of it, and like, nah, like they didn't, it's bad. Anyway, sorry.
That's
I didn't mean to have a 10-minute tangent on AC the movie. So the piece I wrote was basically argues I am someone that is generally for sort of like convoluted bullshit mythology. Like, I'm a, you know, X-Files buff. Like, I will defend even some of the worst parts of Lost. In many cases,
About Hurley eating all that mayonnaise?
exactly.
You're gonna defend that?
Let's talk about the Hurley bird. You know, if you really want to go down some rabbit holes, Google search the Hurley bird. I'm not gonna explain it here. I guess side thing, I will say, like, for Lost, for example, its convoluted mythology was often used at, like, in service of something, even if it didn't quite stick the landing, like, it was there in service of something that I thought was worthwhile. X-Files, up until the resolution of Mulder's sister, like the central arc of X-Files, the core of why they developed that show, like, has like a, its convoluted mythology is in service of something that it loses the plot on once they sort of resolve the central mystery and they have to go on for like another six seasons. Assassin's Creed was doing something similar up until roughly the end of Assassin's Creed 2, arguably into Brotherhood a little bit. And for me, I just thought that the moment Patrice, whose last name I cannot pronounce and I don't want to butcher it, but the series creator sort of behind Assassin's Creed, who left in the middle of development of Brotherhood. It just seemed like Ubisoft sort of lost the plot at that point, and that rather like than putting in, like, I'm not going to sit here and argue that the end of Assassin's Creed 2, in which, like, the revelation of a first civilization and, like, these godlike beings who can then talk to the player, fourth-walling, and then is also talking to Ezio. Like, it's a lot of convoluted sci-fi bullshit, but stuff that I thought was really, like, it found a balance in a way that I really enjoyed. Like, it was both, it was the kind of self-serious sci-fi bullshit that, like, gets me really excited in the same way that, like, Lost worked for me. But, like, since then, it never seemed like Ubisoft knew what to do with the pieces they had, and instead they just kind of kept throwing the pieces at the wall, and none of it was really sticking for me, which I thought was evidenced both by the ending of Assassin's Creed 3, which is just like them throwing up their hands and going, I don't know, like, can we please just stop it? Like, they basically were begging for a way out and just wrote an ending so they could move on. And then Origins, which, like, is set, you know, before the formal creation of the Assassins and the Templars, basically says, like, how can we run away from all this stuff as much as possible? And then there are, like, bits of it, there are pieces of it, but by and large, like I actually didn't find a bunch of the optional stuff that I have since read about that is in Assassin's Creed Origins that references some of the, sort of, you know, first civilization and the sci-fi machinations that are going on in the larger meta-narrative. And it just seems like Origins runs away from it because it's like, we didn't know what to do with this anymore, so we're just going to kind of pretend it's not there. And so I propose that actually, because Ubisoft has largely demonstrated they don't know what to do with its sort of meta-narrative at this point, that they would be better serviced by just getting rid of it and focusing on sort of the historical narrative part of the series, which, at least for me, has become the appeal of those games as I've sort of lost the plot on the through line for the meta-narrative stuff. But, Daniel, I don't know how much you have played these games. I know, Cameron, you have strong feelings about these games and the meta-narrative, but that is where I came.
Cameron, I'm gonna go ahead.
No,
Cameron,
I'm gonna let you go
because my history with the series is spotty. I have kind of played a few of them, and I'll be clear, I love sci-fi bullshit. Like, I actively love it. I love a lot of lore, I love a lot of world building, I love a lot of, you know, ridiculous convoluted plot stuff. But I know that sometimes you gotta quit while you're ahead, and it does not sound like they did that with this series. However, Cameron, I know you've got strong opinions. I'm going to let you take your mall thoughts and do it up. I'm going to let you do that.
I don't know if the viewers have the, or the listeners have the
you know, I just realized that they didn't. We had a conversation prior to this that Cameron spent some time in a mall today and was tweeting about Assassin's Creed from a mall. So I apologize for the inside joke, but now you know where it's from.
Mm-hmm. Now we're all in the know. I mean, I don't think, Patrick, I don't think you're wrong, right? Like, in a general sense, I think that there's a pretty clear demarcation point between, or there's a periodization, maybe, between Assassin's Creed 1 and then Assassin's Creed 3, right? That ending of Assassin's Creed 3 where this meta plot of a solar flare that is going to wipe out all of humanity, much like what happened to the first civilization, can either be prevented by Desmond, or it can happen and, I guess, wipe out all of civilization, effects unknown. Like, I think that's right, and I think that it gets a little bit goofy. I also feel like if you're invested in that meta plot from Assassin's Creed 1 through two Brotherhood Revelations and then 3, it makes up a really interesting and good plot arc. Like, I think that there is a strong narrative arc there. And kind of like you were saying, the end of Assassin's Creed 2 is really where that kicks in, right? Where the first civilization person, I don't remember which one it is at that point. Is it
Minerva? Minerva is the end of 2, and then Juno is the one that's introduced in 3, and then there's a guy who Jupiter? I think Jupiter might be it that is maybe referenced in some of. I like started going down some wiki holes, and it was like,
yeah, of course.
So Revelations is the one I didn't play. I didn't play Rogue either, but Rogue was a side one. But like Revelations is like one of the main ones I didn't. Like I was like, I'm done with Ezio. Like as much as like old Ezio was interesting to me, it was like I just. I'm off this train for a little while.
So this maybe is a piece that makes it all come together for me. Revelations, I've been very outspoken in the past about Assassin's Creed Revelations being the best game in the series. I think
really?
It is. I think it's very, very good, but mostly because it is a game that plugs in a lot of holes in various places. So Revelations, I guess I'll say Assassin's Creed 2, right, has this big moment where Minerva is talking to Desmond and not talking to Ezio, right? Like looking dead into the camera of the game and talking to the player, but really is talking to Desmond, operating the Animus. And at that point, you're like, well, what would cause that to happen, right? Like, what would that be? And then through Brotherhood and Revelations, and then 3... we get this kind of plot line that suggests that the first civilization's whole existence, like they knew that their civilization was coming to an end, both from internal and external pressure, the internal stuff being like their creation of humans is like a slave race that then humans did not care for, and then they break out. That's
because
they were
dealing with like the solar flare sort of impending, and then also basically a war with like the enslaved human population.
Yeah, and that's like the Adam and Eve stuff where you find all the apples of Eden and all the artwork and stuff in Assassin's Creed 2. So there's that part, but then you find out that like what the first civilization did was dedicate their scientific minds to manipulating probability down through time. Right, so Ezio showing up beneath the Vatican, right, after he beats the Pope to death.
Oh, God, that's right.
The ending of Assassin's Creed 2 is, like, one of the, like, top 10, like, finales to a video game of all time. Like, it is
100%. Like, maybe top 5, yeah, exactly. It's very strong. Ezio is there not because Ezio needs to be there, right? Or because the Apple of Eden is important. Ezio is there because it's important for Minerva, who is in that vault, to be able to speak to Desmond while Desmond is possessing Ezio in the memory. Like, right. And that's like expanding brain meme shit, right? Like, it's just blowing up. And like, I really love that. So that's one side of it. Like, I think that big science fiction bullshit is very cool conceptually. Okay, so that's kind of one plank of my defense. Despite how big and weird it gets, like, that core idea of thinking through the implications of timelines and what the Animus is actually having you do, which is live through the genetic memories of your ancestors. Okay, so that's one. The other thing that I really like, and this has the most to do with Revelations, is that Revelations is kind of a side game in which Desmond is trapped inside the Animus with Clay, who is the subject that was before Desmond, and who is the person who was leaving all those weird clues for Desmond during the first three games.
Those
really.
Were like the puzzles the optional puzzle objectives you could solve, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you had to, like, so Clay shift is the around one who's some puzzle pieces, that. And then you would get like some mysterious voiceover, and if you did all of them, then you got like I think that's like how you got like the original Adam and Eve cutscene, right? Was by solving all those in 2 or something.
Finding
like that.
Every last one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I did that.
Me too. Yeah, perfect. I was obsessed with 2 and Brotherhood.
But yeah, so that's where you saw that original cutscene and them like jumping through the window and all of that. But so what happens in Revelations is you get it's like almost little side stories. So part of it is Ezio traveling to Turkey and kind of dealing with Turkish court politics, which is quite interesting. And then the other part is going back to Altair and playing the very end of Altair's the existence of his assassin's enclave that he kind of inherits / takes over at the end of the first Assassin's Creed game. And in within that, it's this thing about responsibility. And for both of these kind of characters at the end of their life, like, what do the assassins accomplish? And what does it, an individual life matter, both within the Assassins versus Templars plot, and then within the broader plot of them just being vehicles for changing things in the future? Like, they are a vehicle for Desmond to experience life through so that he can do stuff to prevent the solar flare in 2000 and whenever.
Right.
Whenever Assassin's Creed 3 ends.
Right.
2000XX. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's actually, like, not the year that the game came out. I think it might still be 2008 or 2009.
Oh, okay. That's even better.
Oh, no. It might be the 2012, because with the end of the world prophecy stuff and all
of
that.
Oh my god, I didn't realize it was tied into that too.
Yeah, that's like perfect. Every conspiracy that's ever been floated is true in the Assassin's Creed universe. But that, like, all of those. So when you're talking about Lost, Patrick, and you're talking about, like, you appreciate all the pieces even when they don't stick the landing, I feel like Assassin's Creed, like, that's what the franchise is. It's setting up some huge narrative pieces that if you're careful, if you care to play every game in the franchise, which is like a I think a hard sell, I think it really interweaves together in a really profound and rewarding way. But if you're just in it to, like, do assassins in history, I think that I think it's less rewarding.
Well, I guess that's you know, like, I buy that as clearly as someone that has invested more, but seen more of, like, the sort of surrounding narrative that kind of plugs in those holes. I guess, like, what I've grown frustrated with is someone that, like, largely just plays sort of, like, the primary entries in the franchise, like, hasn't invested much in sort of the outside material or sort of, like, filling in those gaps through reading, you know, wikis and things like that. It in that version of playing the games, especially over the periods of time that it's taken place, like, it feels disconnected and in a way that doesn't give me the sense that they actually know where they're going, and that, but, like, plugging it in through, like, novels and side things, it almost feels like they're saying, like, ah, like, okay, like, we're not really sure where this is going, like, here, but here's some interesting stories. Like, I just, the main thrust of it just seems like I've just grown tired of it in a way that I would. That's why, you know, I made that argument at the end, was just like, just get rid of it, like, just move on, like, especially because in Origins, like, it's just so bizarre because there's no context for any of it. Like, if you, Origins was your first version of Assassin's Creed, like, when a guy just starts waving around, like, a magical apple and, like, casting, like, weird illusions, it's like, at no point does the game, like, sit down and go, like, so here's the thing, here's what's going on in this world. Like, it presumes a lot about the player in a context that I don't know if necessarily works for the game and what it's presenting. Like, it as sort of like a soft reboot of, like, reintroducing people into what it is, like, I don't know if it necessarily executes on that. But I'm curious, for you, Danielle, like, as someone that is into, like, a lot of, like, as self-professed sci-fi bullshit, like,
oh,
like,
yeah,
what are worlds that, you know, similar, like, where you can see, like, you know, like, I bet Cameron and I could go on for, like, another, like, 20 minutes about this, but, like, for you, like, what is the one that you could go on for, like, another 20 minutes about, like, what are the worlds that, like, even when they kind of go off the rails, like, the one that you've sort of, like, fallen down the rabbit hole on because of one reason or another?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is just sort of something that appeals to me in general. I really like to get obsessed with worlds. Like, I guess one example in a game, of course, is, like, how many hours I spent in Alien Isolation looking at, like, every poster and every magazine and every, like, last art asset for details about that world, about that, you know, sort of dying dystopia on a spaceship. It was just absolute, you know, catnip for an Alien fan, right? There was just tons and tons and tons of that stuff in that game. I'm obsessed right now with, you know, my current trash can eclair, as we call them, especially on Idle Weekend, is a show called Dark Matter, which is, like, a not great sci-fi series that I adore.
What is it and about? I want to know. What is Dark Matter?
Okay, Dark Matter. Let me sell you on this. I don't know. I don't know if you like kind of trashy sci-fi. I know you like mythology based, like X-Files style.
Look, I watch horror movies. By definition, I am all into right. trash. I like certain like horror movies are like looking through the trash for like the little nuggets of like insight and gold, because most of it is trash. Good. So believe Good. Me, you don't have to sell me on the trash part.
All right, perfect, perfect. We're going to get along in this then. All right, Dark Matter is like a kind of low-budget Canadian sci-fi TV series about a ship of people who wake up and their memories are erased and they have to figure out who they are. And like in the pilot, they find out that they were like mercenaries hired to do all sorts of nasty shit. But because they don't remember why they're bad people, they want to try to be good people. And it's a whole show about that. And it's wonderful. And it is just trope upon trope upon trope. But I am eating it up. Like, it's like delicious candy and I cannot stop eating it. There's just something really satisfying about particular sci-fi worlds that have like way too much detail. Something that I love in this, and I don't know how you both feel about this, but when a technology is introduced and they like go out of their minds trying to explain it, there is a plot thread in this show, and they go back to it a couple of times where a method of travel has been sort of devised. It's like a futuristic universe. You know, corporations rule everything, of course, and the police are corrupt. It's actually kind of a little bit of a, has a little bit of a nice progressive leftist bent to it, even though it's like a trashy sci-fi show. So, you know, of course I'm eating it up. But this technology was invented where your body is like scanned and they do a full genetic scan of you. They use that information to make a clone of yourself at any of like 1,000 planets or whatever the number is. Your clone goes to that planet for 3 days, for 72 hours, experiences whatever they experience on vacation or for whatever purpose. And then the clone is dissolved and the memories are uploaded to your brain back home. So it's
dissolved?
Like you went there
what do
you
mean
did
it's
this.
Dissolved? What, how does it?
It's recycled matter. They don't go into that. I'm sure that'll be like a future. That'll be like a future thing, right?
It's like an easy thing to gloss over is like what happens to this fucking clone? Oh, it gets dissolved. Well, that could mean a lot of different things.
Yeah, there's a few games about that particular Swapper. It's a little bit like that, probably. But yeah, like they go into this so much. There is a commercial that one of the main characters views, like while he's waiting for the doctor's office or something about this. And then later on, in a later episode, he actually does it, and then he watches like a different commercial about it. And then later on in that episode, other characters, like as a point of exposition, talk about this technology. So there's no way you can get lost here, right? Every piece of this technology has been laid out for you narratively. And I am just a sucker for that stuff. I just love that kind of world building where it's like, all right, somebody drew a diagram. In like the writer's room where like somebody didn't get it. Somebody had a brilliant idea. Somebody didn't get it. They drew out a diagram. They had a whole thing, just basically that nerds made this thing. It just makes me happy. I just love that kind of shit. It's good. It's good stuff. I'm also the kind of kid who had Next Generation blueprints up in her bedroom. Like I had the blueprints of the Enterprise D up in my bedroom.
That's very good.
So, yeah. Good shit. It's really good shit. I just love that kind of detail. It makes it a little more real to me, even though I know it's not actually real. It makes it feel real in a good way, and it makes it feel like, oh, I can actually, put my brain in this sort of universe for a while. I can actually escape into this. I can have, my clone go into this, and then my memories will come back. It's perfect. It works.
Well, it's funny, because speaking of like my interest in horror films, is that I am always excited when I come across a horror franchise that has like more than 10 films in it, or like let's say more than six. And the reason is like because I'm just genuinely curious how they keep the gambit going. Like I'm like world building has to occur. Like they have to justify a sequel. Now often like their justification for that is like extremely loose, but even for the most monotonous of franchises, at certain points, they have to take some kind of risk with the premise or the pretext for why it's occurring. Like, I mean, there's the cliche that if you make it to 10 movies, eventually you go to space, right? Like that happened to Jason. Leprechaun went to space twice, didn't quite make it to 10 movies. I believe Leprechaun is at like 7 or 8 last I counted. Hellraiser, definitely 10 or is it 9? But that went to space at one point, like the lament configuration, the box from Hellraiser turns into a giant spaceship in one of the later ones. Oh yeah. Cool. Oh, it's good. It's very good.
I need to see this. Oh my God.
Oh, the space one is extremely, extremely bad. But it's extremely good. And like, it's a similar sort of thing where like, I am extremely attracted to, like, sort of, in some ways, like, the desperation to have to make another one of these things. And so when, I have never watched the full Halloween series, like, for reasons unknown. But I want to at some point because it's a very thin premise that apparently they stretched out to, like, 8 or 9 films, and by most accounts didn't really mix up a whole lot of the reason it happens over and over, which in fact makes me more curious, because the other ones are like, well, we're sending this leprechaun to, like, a bad part of the city, and then we're sending him to space, or, like, Hellraiser is going to space, or another one, Pinhead gets uploaded to the internet. Like, they just come up with fucking batshit crazy reasons, like, to justify making a sequel, but I'm always super curious to find the world-building explanation for, like, well, we gotta make another one of these. Like, here's what we came up with this time. Like, in the Friday the 13th, like, a series that is extremely repetitive, like, in one of them, like, it takes place in, like, all in someone's head. Like, they have actually imagined a whole Friday the 13th episode in their head, like, which is actually kind of a fascinating premise for a bad movie. It's not good, but, like, on paper, it's like, well, that's kind of like a clever way to think about how you would do another one of those. So that is my personal attraction to, like, sort of these never-ending narratives, because I'm always just fascinated by, like, what are you gonna, like, you should stop doing this. You should just stop doing this. But, like, what if we did another one of them? And so that's why I'm always excited when I'm like, oh, here's another one where there's, like, 13 movies. Like, all right, time to spend too much money watching a bunch of trash.
Yeah, there is a really beautiful push and pull between the clear sign that somebody just put their hands up and was like, oh, my God, whatever, let's get a paycheck. And then the other side of it where it's like, if we're going to do this, we're going to go for it. And goes totally batshit, like, completely goes for it. Either in a performance or in some aspect of it or in the writing. Like, I do love that too. There's something kind of beautiful about that. Ugh. Cameron, I don't know where you fall on this particular thing or if there are aspects like that that you can note that are like the sci-fi bullshit that you like.
That's, I mean, it's thing. The Assassin's Creed franchise.
There we go.
Whatever. You just tweeted about the fact that you read the novelization for Mortal Kombat the movie. An adaptation of an adaptation.
Wait, yeah, I like, what?
I like a good novelization. I like a good I like reading the Baldur's Gate video game adaptations.
Does that exist? There's a thing?
Yes, they are notorious for killing, like, well-loved characters in the middle of it that are, like, canonically not dead at the end of the first game. Yeah, it's real good.
Oh, God. Is the thing, you know, this is probably a not the best question, but is the thing that separates that sort of thing, like an official novelization, from fan fiction, is it just the fact that it's endorsed, you know, by whatever brand? Is it just the fact that it's sold in a bookstore or wherever fine, you know, books are sold? Is that the only thing that actually separates a work from fan fiction?
I mean, I guess so. I have no idea. Like, it just, it seems like fan fiction to me. Like, things that happen in those books do not happen canonically, right?
Yeah.
Like, people do different things. They're, like, especially with the Mortal Kombat stuff and, like, basically any movie novelization, they're often based on the earliest versions of the screenplays. So, like, there's a novelization for the movie The Thing that, like, really takes a curve in the middle. There's one for Alien as well that has, like,
I've heard the Alien one is, like famously fucking weird.
Yeah, because it's based on, like, a version of the script that's not even close to the shooting script. Wow. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess they're just fan fiction that you have to pay, like, $7 for. I'm very invested in the Forgotten Realms Dungeons & Dragons official setting. Oh. Just conceptually, I've read a lot of novels that are set in that world. So, like, yeah, I mean, that's not science fiction. That's fantasy bullshit. But
well, that sounds like you're in for your Forgotten Realms is like my puppet master or Hellraiser. It's like, all right,
yes,
I know this is bad, but you know what? It's got that branding. It's got mm-hmm. That's good enough for me. Maybe I can find like that's like how I explain that Hellraiser 5's all right because it's sort of like Silent Hill. That's not a defense or an explanation. It's just what I tell myself for why I own that movie on DVD and Blu-ray. Get over it.
Do you know what Spelljammer is, Patrick?
No, that sounds familiar, though.
Spelljammer? I'm not sure.
What's I like it, though. It's a good name.
This is, we're really missing Austin here. This
yeah.
is a
oh,
real,
no.
he's going to hear this.
It's
just someone send this clip
computer.
And he is just going to scream into a microphone. Like, maybe right now he's screaming into a microphone and he doesn't know why.
Yeah. It's basically like, what if there was a high fantasy world, the Forgotten Realms, say, some sort of Lord of the Ringsy kind of fantasy, and wizards figured out how to make interplanetary spaceships or interdimensional spaceships,
what?
And then they flew them around.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rad.
What if?
They're like made of wood.
Do it. Wait, they're made of wood? No.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. No. It's like literally a boat that just flies like through the different planes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That is, okay. I'm not... Yeah. Fantasy is not
that's
really
beautiful.
My thing, but that is like some fantasy sci-fi bullshit that I can get on board with that. When we were talking earlier on Twitter, someone mentioned the Doom tie-in novels, which I definitely read. Knee Deep in the Dead was definitely the title of one of those.
Oh boy!
I think there were three of them, and what made those fast because I loved. Doom 2 Hell on Earth was like the game that my dad bought with our first real computer, and nice. Like I'd had exposure to video games through like the NES and stuff like that, but Doom 2 was like the first computer game that I ever played, and so like through lack of a bit like, you know, the difference between like, you know, Patrick Klubik, you know, 32-year-old Patrick Klubik now and whatever, you know, 11-year-old Patrick Klubik then, was that like I didn't have access to other worlds, and so I just became in like Doom was a good game, like it's fine, but that was not a game that pretended it was doing a lot of world building. But because it was a big franchise, the only way that you can merchandise a franchise is to world build on top of it, regardless of whether like it justifies it in the first place. And so the Doom tie-in novels like give a name and a backstory to the unnamed Doom Marine in the Doom series, and I was
what was his name?
I don't remember. Mr. Doom Marine is the best I
Larry
can give you.
Doom.
Larry God. Doom. You know what? It probably was something terrible like that. And I remember I think those books had like sex in it, and I was definitely like probably too young to be reading like a book like that. They were
like
gross.
Demon sex? Is
I
he
don't
having
know.
Sex
I
with
just,
like the demons?
I want to say
you know.
I want to say
you
yes,
remember.
But I don't remember. I want to remember. I just remember reading parts of those books and going, I probably shouldn't be reading those. I also remember having them in my backpack. I would read them to and from middle school, and I definitely got made fun of by a girl for having the Doom Tie novel. And
oh, no.
Can I tell you the name of this?
Catherine! I remember her name. I'm not going to say her last name. I remember,
you remember
her
name, but not Mr. Doom?
Yeah, well, getting made fun of for having the books at a middle school age, I guess, made a more indelible impression on my ego than whatever.
That's
the name
fair.
Of the Doom. I'm going to look up the Doom.
His name's
tie-in.
Flynn Taggart.
Is it?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah,
his
that
name
sounds
is
right.
Flynn Taggart.
That sounds right. Is
that's
one of the books is called Knee
name.
Deep in the Dead, right?
Hold on. Yes, that's the first one.
What? Are they all? They can't all be named after the difficulty, because Knee Deep in the Dead is one of the difficulty levels that you can choose in Doom. I don't think the others are based on. Okay, give me one of the other ones. Hit me.
I don't. It's oh Doom. I don't know. Hold on.
You don't have the other ones?
No, I'm
were
sorry.
You
I'm
just
sorry.
Just gonna make something up right there.
Doom tie-in novel.
It sounds like maybe you're about to make something up. Like,
yeah.
No.
Okay.
No,
Doom.
I wasn't.
Hell on Earth, Infernal Sky, and Endgame.
Gotcha. I was looking at the reboot. That was I got caught up because the novels were rebooted, and the first reboot novel is Worlds on Fire.
No, so I didn't. I didn't read those. Those Worlds on Fire. When did that happen?
after Doom 3.
Apparently. Oh, Doom 3. Okay. No, 2008. I was far too sophisticated to be reading Doom tie-in novels.
Mm-hmm.
I had moved on to obsessively reading message board threads that were photoshopping excerpts from Lost episodes. I was far too sophisticated for Worlds on Fire.
Isn't one of the Hellraiser movies also named Endgame?
It has to be.
I don't think so. I'm going to look. I don't
or
think
Or maybe
that's
a Jason
true.
Movie?
No, definitely not a Jason movie. Hellraiser Saga.
No, Bloodline.
Bloodline,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Inferno, I believe, is the one that is silent hellish. Silent
oh,
hellish.
Wait, there's Hellraiser. There is. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Painbringer Hellraiser Endgame HD is a fan-made music video, though, using Hellraiser.
Good.
So there's like a Hellraiser Endgame thing. It's just, you know, maybe not
official.
I
feel like that's a good enough explanation. I
feel there
like
we go.
Fine. Anyway.
Good shit. I have one last question for this before we go to the question bucket. And it really is, how much of this... As a complete, like, you know, as a genre trope, and I actually think it's pretty interesting that we have, like, fantasy, sci-fi, and horror. We're probably all kind of fans of all of it, but it seems like maybe we have one badge, you know, sort of higher up than the others, each of us, which is cool, and it applies to all of these. But how much of loving, you know, sort of bullshit lore and bullshit sci-fi stuff, how much of this is kind of a symptom of just living in a world of transmedia giant properties? Like, how much of this is because of that, directly because of that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, when Patrick was talking earlier and kind of giving his spiel about Assassin's Creed, I just wrote down Star Wars, right? Because this it's the same problem as Star Wars, right? Like, you can find out, you can go down the rabbit hole of any given character in the Mos Eisley Cantina, right? And get the full bullshit
books,
experience.
Tales of the Cantina.
Oh my god.
Yep.
Was that a line of books?
I mean, there were a series of short stories. Uh-huh. Basically for like tales of this, tales of, like Tales of Jabba's Palace, Tales of the Cantina, Tales of God the Bounty Hunters, where any little scene and scenario where there was like more than one character, there was a short story for their entire
that sounds about right.
life and backstory and all of that, and I was a big old fan. And did you know that in one of those, Boba Fett was this like anti-drug, like straight edge dude who was like, it's cool to kill people over like the drug war. There's some weird politics in those. I'm just gonna say that. But yes, sorry.
Weird.
Yeah.
Just say no.
Sorry. just say no, Boba Fett.
Just say Bobo.
Jango Fett in the prequels. Listen, young Boba. Say no.
Just say no, son. Just say no.
I actually think to some extent the ability to have like sort of like transmedia properties like if used correctly, like not to go back to Lost, but like Lost actually like was an early example of I think using that effectively. Like if you were a fan of Lost when it was on TV, you'll remember during the periods where the finales aired on in May and the premieres happened in September, for a number of seasons, there were these events, ARGs, that happen during the summer in which they would both tease like sort of like what was happening in like kind of themes or character names about what was going to happen in the upcoming season, but also would answer like smaller questions that like weren't the bigger ones that need to be answered by the show, but would end up giving you sort of like resolution to some of the smaller things that maybe you were particularly obsessed with. And it was an example of, I thought, them using a transmedia sort of narrative in a way that satisfied like the kinds of people that would be interested in that sort of thing, but didn't come at a cost of alienating people who didn't participate in that. Like any of the stuff that you learned in the summer things, for what I remember, didn't necessarily undercut, like, this is assuming that you're okay with what was told on the show. Like, I have plenty of criticisms of the show, but I'm saying, like, generally speaking, the stuff you missed in the summer stuff was really for the hardest of the hardcore, as opposed to being something that you would have missed if you were just watching during the regular seasons. Like, the one exception to that is that they, Mobisodes was a thing with Lost.
Oh!
They aired exclusively on Verizon cell phones.
Oh, no.
Like, and one of them answered like a big central question to parts of Lost involving a certain dog. And oh, no. It was bullshit that was like an instance in which, like, due to a like corporate sponsorship, it meant certain people then had to pirate these fucking like 2-minute episodes that were just like little pieces from the Lost universe. Get me angry. I gotta stop talking about Lost. Anyway, sorry.
Where'd that dog go?
Well, that's how they're gonna justify the reboot.
Oh no. The dog's name was Verizon, of course.
There you go. It's the one question they never answered. What was the dog's real name? It was not Vincent. It was Verizon.
I can see how you'd make that mistake.
Good boy, Verizon.
Very good. Very good. Oh, man. I think we should reach into the question bucket, maybe just for one.
Sure.
One question here today. And this one comes in from Michael from Sweden. And Michael writes, "Dearest Waypoint, during one of your recent episodes, Rob mentioned that video games are pretty good at portraying loss. I think this is in discussion about either Wolfenstein or the Banner Saga. And I started to think about how often we praise elements of games for being, quote, good for a video game, end quote. What are your examples that have dealt with themes, concepts, or issues in a way that's not only good for being a video game, but actually excel to a degree that you put it up against any other type of media? For example, I think last year's Hitman game did an excellent job of portraying place, and I don't think any World War II movie has made me feel as tense as some of the earlier levels in the first Call of Duty did when I was a kid. Thank you for your fantastic website and your blessed Twitter feed. Sincerely, Michael from Sweden." I'll start off with a sweet one, I think a nice one. And that would actually be, I think the writing in Butterfly Soup is actually good enough and fun enough. And the presentation being like a visual novel, which incorporates a lot of things like text messages and instant messenger and things like that. I think it actually would stand up to kind of any piece of young adult fiction at this point. I think the characters are well drawn enough and it's actually funny enough and sort of heartfelt enough that, yeah, I would put it up there against anything in that genre. I think it really works super, super well.
So I just finished Life is Strange Before the Storm, sort of the three episode prequel, and not perfect. The third episode is sort of all over the place in some unfortunate ways, but sort of like the central sort of dynamic in Before the Storm is the relationship between Chloe Price and Rachel Amber, which I think the prequel like totally nails. And part of what I think it nails is sort of which thing is relatable regardless of whether you look at Rachel and Chloe as like canonically, you know, like romantically involved or just like close friends, like whatever the case may be, however you look at their relationship, like what the Before the Storm does really well is like plays with and lets you as the choice maker play with sort of like the fluidity of relationships when you are especially a teenager and you're both figuring out yourself and your hormones and your how you interact with other people and just how things change from a friendship to something more intimate, and like the way that Life is Strange lets you express that but also back off it, like in the way it does it and the way that you get to interact with those choices and make those choices and think about those choices is only something a video game can pull off. That's not to say that all the mediums aren't fully capable of like showing like interesting dynamics of relationships, but only video games allow you to participate in that sort of active choice as that sort of plays out, and especially as someone that like, you know, like it's been a long time since I've been a teenager, and it's like interesting to then go back to that place and think about how you felt. Because I can't, you know, I can't pretend that didn't, you know, although my, you know, my own relationships were different than, you know, the one that is Chloe and Rachel, like a lot of the same elements are at play, and a video game allowed me to sort of explore that and kind of like work through those emotions in a way that I just, you know, is not good for a video game. It's just something that could only happen in a video game.
Yeah, co-sign that example for sure. That is a really, really good one. Cameron, do you have any specifics for these?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I don't know. So Patrick, what you just said, right, is that that the ability to kind of live through the implications and choices within that game empowers that narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's important about the question is that, like, your answer leans into the video gaminess and the uniqueness of the medium,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, like, just blanket, like, the way that the story is told or the narrative beats or whatever. And I have a really hard time. I mean, I write a lot about video game narrative. It's like a thing that I'm invested in thinking about video game stories and how they work. I have a really hard time thinking about a game that is as good as, like, a novel. Like, there are a lot of science fiction novels in particular that I really enjoy. I don't know if there are a huge number of video game stories I find scratch the same itch that I would say you should rather play this video game than read this given novel. I think the Planescape, both original Planescape Torment and the newest one, whatever, Torment, I guess is what it's called. I think that those are unique science fiction stories that hold up to the rest of the genre, agnostic of medium. But I have a really hard time with, like, interpersonal drama in video games being a thing that I think can be evaluated that way.
Mm-hmm.
I bounce off of, I really enjoyed the first Life is Strange. I played the first episode of the second season of Life is Strange and bounced off of it very, very hard.
I don't think it'll change if you, like, yeah. like basically if the first episode didn't work, there's almost nothing about the rest of it that I think would change your mind.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, Cameron, I think that's definitely fair. For me personally, I think there are moments that work really well, moment to moment, in terms of gameplay. I do have a hard time sometimes with game stories kind of working the whole time, the way that a really great novel or a really great movie will work. But I do think in the moment to moment there can be those kinds of revelations in games that make you feel a little bit special for doing that. So
yeah.
Yeah, especially in the example that Patrick gave, there really is a really great moment with Chloe and Rachel Amber, and it's Chloe remarking that she thinks she smells bad, and she gets really, like, nervous about it, and it's like, whether you back off, it's like a really great moment that is really nails that feeling and that just sort of, oh my god, teen. Sort of moment. So yeah, sorry, I'm interrupting you. Go ahead.
No. I mean, I think that's. I am yearning, and you know, I make a concentrated effort to play a lot of stuff kind of on the periphery of games culture or whatever that is, because I'm just not sure that, like, I love AAA games. I love big budget experiences. I'm not sure that the things that I enjoy the most about video games happen necessarily in those places. So, like, mm-hmm. a game like Bee's Wing by Jack King Spooner is amazing. It's really good. I think that is something that kind of holds up to the level of like, a contemporary novel that you might read. But, yeah, it's very hard for me. I liked Assassin's Creed Origins. Very hard for me to say, hey, you should do this instead of reading, like, a Samuel Delaney novel or an Ursula Le Guin novel or something like that, or like watching a good science fiction movie, watching Primer, right?
I mean, even the phrase, like, good for video game, like, comes from a defensive posture that I think is natural for anyone. You know, I'm sure all of us have used that phrase, and it often comes from a place of, like, when you're trying to explain to someone that why you're so invested in video games as a medium, when even though if you are invested, you probably are well aware of its faults and what its strengths are and what it's still figuring out the language to express, and knowing full well it may never figure out the language to express certain kinds of stories or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I mean, this is, you know, I'm back to, you know, when Austin and I wrote responses to Ian Bogost's, like, story, essay about, you know, whether games should have stories, you know, like, the angle I took was that games didn't have they don't have a choice. Like, they have to tell stories because, like, for, like, a lot of people, games are their medium of choice. And so, like, whether or not they're, you know, Cameron, to your point that, like, would you recommend, you know, Assassin's Creed Origins over, like, a novel that dealt with, like, similar themes, there are people that will never care to read that book. And so, in some ways, what I was arguing was that it's incumbent on games to try and find the language to be able to tell those stories, not because they need to match a novel, but because for a lot of people, if they're ever going to seek out those things or find those things, it'll ultimately have to happen through games. And so, I'm not sure we'll ever get past the point where it's good for a video game, because that also is rooted in this defensive posture, you know, vis-a-vis other mediums. And at some point, it's just, you know, some way you just have to judge it for what it is, as opposed to like what it could be relative to something else. Because in some ways, those comparisons are always going to be faulty.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of where I am with it too, right? Like, I'm very materially and intellectually invested in the idea of finding things that are unique and cool and doing really intriguing things within video games within all of those parameters you just laid out, right? Like,
yeah,
within a realist framework, I guess.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I also like the idea of kind of being honest about a lot of things. I've had my come to Jesus with a lot of this. Not that recently, but in the last few years, as my tastes have, you know, sort of maybe shifted a tiny bit, and weirdly, the last year was a year where I got a lot of things that I also used to love. I'm not used to getting a lot of good 3D platformers anymore, so it was interesting and different in that way. But you know, sort of before that, I was sort of having a come to terms with the fact that, like, you know what, sometimes I like cheesy shit. Like, I just do. Like, it's and kind of being happy with that and, like, making peace with that and kind of being like, yeah, you know what? It's cool. Give me my teen stuff sometimes. Or give me my, like, cheesy-ass sci-fi story about, you know, the people who wake up on a ship and they don't really have any memory anymore.
Like, and don't call it a guilty pleasure, right? Like, I think we've fallen into that trap sometimes where it's like, just because everything you experience is not, like, the high end of intellectualism, right. Like,
yeah.
That doesn't mean it can't be enjoyable. Like, I mean, I think, like, you know, the fulfilling your own needs, desires, and wants, and like it, even to a medium, like, is to, you know, is at its best when it's, you know, able to kind of like run that whole spectrum, and not everything has to be the thing where you're gonna go turn around and write 1,300 words about what was so interesting about it. Sometimes it just like fills a gap for a weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
15 minutes ago, I was just explaining about wizard spaceships. So.
Yes!
What was that called again? Please, Nick.
Spelljammer.
Spelljammer. It's even a good name.
It's very good. It's like a Dungeons & Dragons property, but like much, much bigger and weirder than the other things.
I am adding Austin Walker and just writing Spelljammers to him, because I know that will just cause him like anxiety. Like, why would Patrick of all people just tweet at me Spelljammers? Mm-hmm. So this is very good.
Mm-hmm. If he's asleep right now, he just woke up. Yeah. He just bolted awake.
Yeah, he is having like a mild heart attack. Like he has a push notification. Like his iPhone is on like do not disturb, except for Spelljammers.
Mm-hmm. It was a take so good he had to wake up.
Oh my god!
Well, we can't top that. That's it. Podcast over.
You did it, Cameron. You had the best line ever. I just have to tell people to send questions to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. I have to say shout outs to Bowen letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine, and tell all the people to find us on Twitter @Waypoint, on Facebook @WaypointVice, on YouTube @WaypointVice, and of course all the things we do at waypoint.vice.com. Cam, where can people find you? And go ahead and plug something if you'd like as well.
You can find me on Waypoint. I write a weekly column every Friday called Postscript. I've been writing that for about a year now. There's more than a year's worth of backlog.
There's
a
lot of good stuff.
So interested, and I write fairly frequently throughout the week too. Go read that right now.
Hell yeah! Actually, it'll be up probably right before the podcast goes up. So good timing on that one as well. Patrick, mm-hmm. Where can people find you?
You can find me looking up the Spelljammers at Patrick Kupik on Twitter. Or it's at who's at Spelljammers on Twitter. Who are you?
Spelljammer. Yeah.
Who's at Spelljammers? We're finding out. Wait. Okay.
Twitter. Is it a real one?
Hold on. We're looking.
Somebody's got it.
Spelljammers.
If it's available.
The page does not exist.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Well.
I think we know.
Get on that.
Woke spell jammers, right there. You got it. Grab it. Jammer. Grab it.
I've opened
woke, the woke jammer.
Mm. Well, it's a door to a different dimension, Cameron. So, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You got to open that door. You got to just be brave, be fearless, open that door to another dimension. I am at Danielle RI on Twitter, and I shall remind you all to be good and be good at it and open your woke door.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.